I don't know what you know about C.S. Lewis's own history, but the book which may have given its name to fantasy literature, Fantasties, by George MacDonald, one of C.S. Lewis's mentors, Lewis gives credit for a good portion of his conversion, reconversion, to the Christian faith. Lewis was baptized into the Christian faith and life, but he later became an agnostic and an atheist, and he said that if you want to stay an atheist, you have to be careful what you read. Because he picked up Fantasties at a book sale somewhere. In England, they're all over the place in little shops, I guess, and little carts. And he picked up Fantasties. And he says Fantasties is what finally at least had a major effect in his returning to the Christian faith, fantasy literature. And he has some essays on them. I didn't dig them out to quote them. You can dig them up for yourself in some of the C.S. Lewis. Just look in the library here under Lewis and you'll find a raft of books, and look up in the bookstore. And check out not only his fantasy literature, but also some of God in the Dock and some of his other essays, because they do have some interesting essays in them. Thank you. Ah, Mission of Mercy. I hope you got one too. Excuse me. You just got back down. Impolite to drink in front of you. But fantasy literature, you know, Christians have pretty much shied away from fantasy, haven't they? Fairy tales. I think it has to do in part from our fear of magic, and in part a consequence of the Renaissance, and printing in today's Christianity, which led us to think that the Christian faith is essentially a logical faith. And so I think we've kind of steered away from fantasy sort of things for that reason. But if you think about it, we're also suspicious about fiction in general. I wonder if in part that's due to the fact that often people accuse the Christian faith of not being verifiable, and we try to make an answer to that and give a defense for it in logical terms. We tend to do that. And there is a place for what's called apology, for attempting to spell out, Lewis was very good at that himself. Mere Christianity is probably one of the best defenses. Although Lewis also said that no doctrine seemed so unsure to him as a doctrine that he had just successfully defended. I guess he figured that if he could defend it, that maybe it couldn't be right, that somehow he got into it. But I think we need to realize that the world of imagination is critical, and we've almost left the world of imagination to the purveyors of today's imagination, to the television and to the before that to the radio and film merchants, who it seems to me we've sort of allowed to take over story and imagination. And we've been suspicious also of imagination. Oh, it's only your imagination. You're imagining things. Again, kind of a negative kind of feeling. Maybe in part that's also related to our concern about graven images. These creatures that we make up and worship. I'm not sure about that. But I'm sure about this, that is our imagination determines to a great deal what we become. If we cannot imagine ourselves doing something, we'll never do it. You ever had that experience? You couldn't imagine yourself being able to do that. Watching the Olympics, somebody pointed out, they said that the Olympic, they were talking about the parallel bars and those kind of the gymnastics, and they said that people are doing things now that were never imagined possible before. In part, that's due to a new glove that's been developed slowly, and the Japanese came up with a very recent trick where there's actually an airspace between your hand and the bar. But then they also said that for the athlete to be able to do any of those exercises, the athlete has to be able to imagine oneself doing those, has to conceive them in their minds, has to have them all down there in that imagination before they can do them. You're nodding in agreement. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't they practice that imagery too?
Well, yes, I mean, you've got to practice the parts of it at certain points, and you also have to know and test your muscle abilities and so forth. But still, even with all of those things, if you can't imagine yourself doing them and have that conception and conceive how it's going to be done.
But all that help in getting that image is helpful.
Right, right. But, pardon? Yeah, and biofeedback and all of those things are certainly related. But without the conception, the visualization, the assumption that here is something that can be done, doesn't happen. And in discussion groups, I often say when people are at a pause point and a question has sort of been put out, and I can sort of look at people and everybody sort of has a kind of a dead look. And it's a good question. I know it's a good question because I've used it with other groups. I'll often say to them, don't be thinking that you can't be thinking of what you're being encouraged to think of, right? Because if you're thinking, I can't think, what are you thinking? All you're thinking is, I can't think. You're imagining that you can't think. That's what's filling your head. And to some degree, we were talking about Schuller earlier on the other side. There is an awareness that Schuller brings to us and reminds us that if you don't think it's possible, you ain't going to do it. Possibility thinking has some validity. So we're called, I think, to develop the realm of imagination and conception and delight and fantasy, including things even such as Pac-Man. You know, when you play a Pac-Man, you know how many of you have ever played a Pac-Man or any of the other video games? Come on, fess up, you adults. Us kids don't mind raising our hands high, but if you really get into the game, you sweat. And when that character dies, what happens to you? Particularly if you're surprised, you feel bad. But also, I found myself, you know, jumping physically back when I've been snatched from a corner that I didn't expect. Our imagination enters into those worlds. Some of you are as old as I am, and maybe you remember Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies comics. They had a character in them called Mary Jane, and she had a little mouse called Sniffles at one point. Anybody remember her? She used to have, at first she had magic sand, and she would drop it on her head, and it would make her as small as Sniffles, and she could go into other worlds. And later, later comics didn't have that magic sand. She used to do a poem then, Huff Huff Hipples Make Me As Small as Sniffles. And I think that's because too many kids were getting it in their eyes, you know, going back to their mothers and saying, I tried it and all I do is... So I'm not sure, but I noticed there's a shift. But Sniffles used to get into pictures and jump into them. And at one point in the Narnia stories, I don't know if any of you have gotten to the Narnia story where they get into the Dawn Treader. They enter through going into a picture. And how many of you have spent time in front of a picture imagining yourself into it? I remember doing that. We had a picture as a child. It was a fairly common one in those days. It was a couple rowing on a little quiet river, and there was sort of a stone bridge. And I would sit and look in that picture for hours and sort of imagine myself in the banks there. Kids who play role, you know, climb into their parents' shoes and clop around in big clothes, aren't only playing games, they're also imagining themselves as their parents and being parents. And that's how they learn to become parents, one of the ways, beside the role models. So, Malcolm Muggeridge one time, you remember Malcolm, know much about Malcolm Muggeridge? He used to be a real strong atheist on British television, and he became a very famous conversion, and the fundamentalists were very proud that they'd caught him. Later became a Roman Catholic, much to their I think in part he may have become a Roman Catholic through reading Lewis and Tolkien, I'm not sure, because he was converted in part through reading Lewis's apologies. And at one point, Malcolm Muggeridge was complaining about television and even about novels and so forth. He said that only the villains are interesting. And I had a chance to interview him, National Association of Religious Broadcasters, and I was there doing some interviewing. I said, but have you read any of Lewis's fiction? And he hadn't. And I said, I would encourage you to read Lewis's fiction because there, the good guys and gals are more interesting than the villains. And they're villains. But the good people are really interesting. It's true of Tolkien as well. Well, I kind of thought maybe some of you might bring some more stuff to read and share from any of your fantasy stuff from Lewis. But I did bring along a few things that I thought we might pause with and take a look at. One of my favorites is his science fiction series also. Have you heard of his science fiction series? Out of the Silent Planet,
oh, yes, I love it.
Paralandra, and That Hideous Strength. In That Hideous Strength, they're fighting an institute called NICE. And I know one woman who said she couldn't say the word NICE after reading after reading that. But I find in Paralandra, for me, one of the most beautiful things was when what were called the Eldillas appeared to Lewis and tried to make themselves somewhat available to them. And he had trouble seeing some of them at certain points because they were too strong. At one point they looked like pinwheels. And another, well, let me just read it rather than talk to you about it. What? Oh. Let us appear to the small one here, said the other, for he is a man and can tell us what is pleasing to their senses. I can see something even now, said Ransom. Would you have the king strain his eyes to see those who come to do him honor? Said the Archon of Paralandra. But look on this and tell us how it deals with you. The very faint light, the almost imperceptible alteration in the visual field, which betokens an Eldil, vanished suddenly. The rosy peaks and the calm pool vanished also. A tornado of sheer monstrosity seemed to be pouring over Ransom. Darting pillars filled with eyes, lighting pulsations of flame, talons and beaks and billowy masses of what suggested snow volleyed through cubes and heptagons into an infinite black void. Stop it! Stop it! He yelled. And the scene cleared. He gazed round, blinking on the field of lilies, and presently gave the Eldils to understand that this kind of appearance was not suited to human sensations. Look then on this, said the voices again. And he looked with some reluctance. And far off between the peaks on the other side of the little valley, there came rolling wheels. There was nothing but that, concentric wheels moving with a rather sickening slowness, one inside the other. There was nothing terrible about them, if you get used to their appalling size, but there was also nothing significant. He bade them to try yet a third time. And suddenly, two human figures stood before him on the opposite side of the lake. They were taller than the Sorns, the giants with whom he had met in Mars. They were perhaps 30 feet high. They were burning white, like white hot iron. The outline of their bodies, when he looked at it steadily against the red landscape, seemed to be faintly, swiftly undulating, as though the permanence of their shape, like that of waterfalls or flames, coexisted with the rushing movement of the matter it contained. For a fraction of an inch inward from this outline, the landscape was just visible through them. Beyond that, they were opaque. Whenever he looked straight at them, they appeared to be rushing toward him with enormous speed. Whenever his eyes took in their surroundings, he realized that they were stationary. This may have been due in part to the fact that their long and sparkling hair stood out straight behind them, as if in a great wind. But if there were a wind, it was not made of air, for no petal of the flowers was shaken. They were not standing quite vertically in relation to the floor of the valley, but to Ransom it appeared, as it appeared to me on earth, when I saw one, that the Eldils were vertical. It was the valley. It was the whole world of Perelandra, which was aslant. He remembered the words of the Oyarsa long ago in Mars, "I am not here in the same way you are here." It was borne in upon him that the creatures were really moving, though not moving in relation to him. This planet, which inevitably seemed to him, while he was in it, an unmoving world, the world, in fact, was to them a thing moving through the heavens. In relation to their own celestial frame of reference, they were rushing forward to keep abreast of the mountain valley. Had they stood still, they would have flashed past him too quickly for him to see, doubly dropped behind the planet's spin on its own axis and by its onward march around the sun. I never saw a better picture of angels than that. One of the things Lewis has done is taken myth, rich myth, and baptized it. Because Mars is ruled by an Oyarsa that's something like the god Mars. And Perelandra by a sort of god, female god, akin to Venus. This is related to our world Venus. He's taken all of that imagination and said, these are little glimmers of what God has been saying all along, and baptized them and given them a Christian significance. I think that's why his fantasies, his novels, breathe authentically Christian faith, in part. Because he sees everything, everything in all creation, all of the old myths in Christ, all of his old training that he had as an English critic and writer, and as a child reading in his father's library and playing and building worlds, came into this world building. And some say that they will far surpass and live well beyond his apologetics, mere Christianity. And the day will become when Christians will remember him mostly for the fantasy novels and for the science fiction, for that reason. What are some of your favorite fantasies and fairy tales other than Lewis? And it's against also some of the other cruel rabbits, right?
There's
right.
Yeah.
It's just large.
Well.
It's
just journey of accomplishment.
And it's important for us to, I think, fantasy nurtures the heroic. Even quotes non-Christian fantasy. Again, like Pac-Man, if you read a book and get into the book gets into you. The character that you find yourself identifying with is in part giving you some of its identity. And it is a way of modeling, is a mediated way of modeling. It's a way of offering other models beyond that which we see in our everyday life. And usually, if you think about it, it emboldens our spirit in the face of seemingly insurmountable obstacles, just as Jonathan Seagull. Or I forget the name of the rabbits in Watership Down that were the Who remembers the names of the rabbit? Hazel. And there's often real death and real bloodshed. One of the things that bothered me about when they put the Narnia Chronicle, the first one, Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, on television, was that they minimized the blood in the battle scene. In part because of overreaction, I think, to violence on television. I agree that we had too much violence in television, but there's an appropriate place. And Lewis had a lot of blood in those battle scenes. Realistic fantasy acknowledges that there's pain and struggle and loss. But says nevertheless, in the face of that, in the face of seemingly impossible, odds against evil, that good can win. Now, I think we need that kind of message today. And we certainly have it in the gospel, but we need it nurtured as many ways as possible. And in real sense, any way that God uses to get that message across to us, that we are no longer hostage to the powers and principalities, so that we give in with the fatalism and say either eat, drink, and be merry, the way some of the hobbits did, and let Frodo run off and stay back in their comfortable hobbit holes and thought Frodo was a little bit nutty. Anything that can encourage us to say, look, though it seems fruitless and useful and useless, something can be done. And also, you may be the one to do it. There's a call to discipleship and an offer of hope. What do you do with magic and fantasy? I used to be troubled with magic and fantasy. Like, in the Narnia Chronicles, the kids do get a few things to help them out. The horn to call when in dire trouble. And the sword. And the healing potion. As I recall, they get that when the winter begins to break, at their little celebration with the beavers. Also in some of the others, magic comes in. Gandalf comes and rescues with some of the magic. That used to bother me a little, because I used to think, hey, this is just sort of it's deus ex machina, like they used to say in the plays. God comes out of the box and everything gets all right all of a sudden. I've changed my mind about that. I'd like to think that now what it's saying is, yes, you may be called, but you need resources beyond yourself. Yeah, sometimes they happen to you like that, right? Something falls in place.
Yeah, and you thank God for it.
It's like when we pray and God says, and does it, had a pastor who was very seriously stricken with a heart attack in our community area. And we had 5 heart attacks and wasn't expected to live. And all the churches prayed that he might live, his church and our church, which was just a mile down the road. Detroit Lutheranism is almost as bad as Minneapolis Lutheranism, where you've got Lutheran churches a few blocks apart. And we all were praying for him, and lo and behold, even though he had a heart attack in the hospital and been for about 5 minutes in length, I understand, he not only survived, but his mind was intact, which it wasn't supposed to be, and he returned to his parish and served for at least 5 or 6 years after that, and then retired. And we were all surprised. We'd been praying that he might be healed, and God did it. So it was kind of like magic. And I think that troubles us. And I think maybe magic is a good thing to have in fantasy, to trouble us and unsettle us, to remind us that, it doesn't just depend upon our grit and determination and calculation and in our own ingenuity.
How else do you get the spiritual message across in fantasy?
Yes, yeah. Otherwise, it's just a hero story. It's not as much of a fantasy, though I would argue all fiction is fantasy. Just levels up. You want to depend on how you want to play around with definitions. So I'm less troubled about magic, and I kind of look for when I see magic now in the fantasy stories as, say, ways of reminding me of the Eucharist, of the gifts of bread and wine, simple things, and of water, simple water, with the word, with the promise. Here it is, it's for you. And recalling and remembering that it is kind of like I've been given a new name. That's magic at baptism. And I'm a new me, I'm a new creature. That's strange and kind of magical. So I'm less troubled by that than I used to be. I used to really be troubled by that. The liturgy. Most good fantasy writers will tell you that they write the story because they have to. They're sort of compelled to. I think there's also design in it and intent to convey to some degree a message. But my guess is that it's not so much that they've got a clear message in mind that they want to get across this point and that point, is that the story grows on them. And I think most writers say that writing is a gift, and to some degree it's almost a curse, that is that some things come in your mind and you've got to do something with them. Yeah, I think Lewis would not want any authorized interpretation of his works to say, in fact, he makes a point in several cases of kind of deliberately obscuring things and saying, in another kind of fantasy, he's done The Great Divorce, which is a fantasy trip to a place that's like heaven, but it's not quite heaven. He says that this isn't really talking about heaven and hell quite. And I don't think he would want you to equate the Eldils exactly with angels, although there are elements of that in it that he wants to convey. And I think he would, let me put it another way. I've used these in sermons. I do use Narnia Chronicles in particular in sermons a lot, because I preach around a lot of different places, so I get a chance to use them again and again. And introduce new people to them. Had a fellow who used to be superintendent of schools in Wazika, Wisconsin, and just got really entranced, so I gave their whole family the box set, because he wanted to hear more of those. I think the stories are best if we don't necessarily unpack them and say this equals that. If we hit it ourselves, or if in discussion somebody says, oh yeah, that's like the angels, or, you know, then let that come out, yeah. But the story just standing is enough. Because it ingrains itself in you in the whole picture. Again, that's partly our Western way of thinking, that we've got to unpack and do kind of exegetical interpretation and say this stands for this, rather than just letting it stand and live in our hearts as a kind of a whole picture. Loving Aslan. I say I do, but I don't think that's necessarily. I don't think. One of my favorites that I use is the story in the last battle. I didn't bring that. Maybe you'll grab it if you get a second. In the last battle, where they're standing inside a stable, and they discover that stable is larger than the whole world that they were in. And Lewis gives us a little hint, because Lucy, the hero in it, says, oh yes, once in our world, there was something in a stable that was bigger than the whole world. But I try not then to interpret them, but just to use them and let the story part itself stand. And put it in the context, yes, of the sermon. But to unpack it too much, I think, ruins some of the fun of it. I think we just got to let the fun be. I used to just go to some of the stuff and mine them for sermon illustrations, and I think that's destructive. I think if it strikes me and I remember it, that's fine. But to, like the Little Prince and a few of those. So some of them are very striking and can be used. But even those, you almost have to let stand as poetry, because if you unpack, it's like somebody once said, if you're preaching a sermon and you're telling a story, like a parable, and then you have to tell people what the parable meant, that's like having to tell what the punchline meant on a joke. You haven't told it right if you've got to tell the punch what it means. And also it's an insult to the intelligence of your hearers. What you're assuming is they can't get it. You ever had somebody just insult you by explaining the joke to you? And preachers do that all the time in preaching. And I think it's the same as with fantasy. We might be able to say it's like this and then just let the story stand without going on to say, and of course they're talking about Bethlehem, and just let it stand. Because I think we need to assume that our hearers have some sense and have confidence with that, to just let it live for itself. I think, by the way, that's sometimes true of the New Testament, that often we over-exegize it so much. Sometimes it's just good just to let, I find that people often themselves instinctively get the meaning far better than a lot of unpacking, sometimes. Not always, because we have a different culture, and we have to get into that culture sometimes to be able to understand it. Let me just mention another book to you that you might be interested in. I don't know if it's in the library here. I didn't think about that in terms of fantasy. But A Visit to Five Brothers and Other Double Exposures by Ewald Bash, also called Joe Bash. You know him? Used to be youth guy for the American Lutheran Church many years ago. Interesting enough, the ALC didn't publish him. Concordia did. And which is intriguing. Prophet without honor. In Visit to Five Brothers and Other Double Exposures, he'll just tell some stories and then you just read the text, sort of counter to that, and you can kind of let the story stand. They're really excellent for this kind. It's a different kind of fantasy. One of them, for instance, the title one, Lazarus really does come back from the grave. And the brothers don't know what to do with him. So they try to bribe him off. And then when they get close, he doesn't say anything to them. And when they get close to him accidentally and accidentally touch him, they discover he's still just as frail as he was before. And so they pull the money back, and then they gently escort him to the gate where he was and tell the cook to give him a few crumbs and walk off whistling past the graveyard. Powerful stuff, and you don't need to unpack it. It gets the message across just by reading the text and counter to it. Different kind of fantasy. I started to mention, and then I thought you might just read a few samples or glance at a few samples of some specifics and tell you about a few that you may not be aware of. That the liturgy, I would encourage you to think of the liturgy as the highest and truest fantasy that we partake in. Notice I did not say only fantasy. Lewis said that the Christian story is the truest myth, the truest story in the world. And when he said myth, He did not mean that it didn't have correspondence to physical happening. What he meant by myth was a story that grasps and encompasses everybody, or the hearers, at least in that culture, and gets into them. And he said it was the truest that he'd ever met. And that's why he was Christian. And he wasn't saying only a myth or only a story. That only is the way we often talk about those things. And I would hope we might learn not to say only fantasy. That one of the reasons I think it's good to think about the liturgy in that way is because, A, it is fantastic. It's beyond our comprehension. That is the world's best hero story and the truest hero story of the one who met evil, defeated it, and gave us the fruits of that victory. And when we hear that story and eat that bread and drink that body, blood, we become participant with Christ, and Christ's home is in us. We are identified with Christ in a way that happens in no other instance except for the very basic first liturgy of baptism, which in the early church took place within the liturgy of communion and was never separated from the liturgy of communion. In fact, the Eastern Orthodox still give the child a little bit of bread and wine in a little teeny silver spoon as part of the baptismal rite. Now, that's the continuing tradition of the church. The Western church got away from it when it got on a mind trip and thought that faith was an intellectual understanding. And even Luther was sensitive to this. Western church wouldn't give the deaf communion because they couldn't understand. They would give them dumb wafers that weren't blessed. Luther said, give them the real thing. Because the deaf couldn't understand. So that this is the most real liturgy in which we participate, the real fantasy, and in the sense of being fantastic and the sense of being formative at the very core and totality of our lives, not just a head trip. It becomes also, it's also an action one that goes beyond the reading of a fantasy. And for us to hear the reading of the scriptures and the knowing of the church year, not simply as telling us something that happened back then, but as a bringing us into the living story of the risen Christ. In the half year of our Lord, in the life of the church year, we participate with Christ in his birth, in his life and struggles, in his dying, in his rising, in his ascension. And it is more than just being reminded of what Jesus did for us back then. That's a very Protestant way of thinking, because it's influenced by intellectual linear thought that puts things back then and says if they're back then, the only way they affect us is through our mind and through the ideas we have and through the intellectual thoughts, so we get to know about Jesus rather than being encompassed by Christ and living in Christ and Christ living in and through us in going out to the world. And that has formative power, as opposed to, or is it richer than, not as opposed to, informative power. The other is information. So you teach people about Jesus. Teaching people about Jesus enables people to talk about Jesus. And we need to do that. That you have to tell the story. But the purpose of telling the story ought to be more than so that people can talk about the story and explain it. Ought to be able to hear the story and listen to it with every bit of wonder, as much wonder as when we get into a fantasy novel. So it has a formative power and a refreshment for our lives. In what sense? On what kind of truth? Well, see, it depends on what you think of by imagination. See, and I think figment of imagination is a Western way of thinking about reality. If what the imagination thinks of is a true reality and has true core reality behind it, then it is no longer just fantasy, but is real fantasy.
And two words are mutually exclusive.
It depends on how you want to define truth and real. Because the realities in Lewis's stories, in one sense you could say they're untrue. I mean, there was no Aslan. Jesus is not a lion. But boy, I believe that Aslan is not a tame lion. And God is not a tame lion. While Aslan allows the children to pet him and to console him in the midst of his grief and in the face of his suffering, and his slaying is going to be slain on the stone table the next day, and while he has this great romp with them and picks them up with his claws and tosses them in the air when he's risen, when the new life has come, sure, the resurrection was not some mice gnawing away at the cords that bound that lion. There is, in a sense, that we are telling a story, and another way of talking about that is that the liturgy is drama. Okay, and from the dramas. I mean, drama is composed.
But does some might not depend upon if one comes just to be entertained, or if one comes as a spectator, or one comes to get something from it?
And I would go a step further to say to participate in.
Right.
Okay.
With your imagination.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very different, even than I back up on this goes to get something from it, because I think that's part of what too many people go to church for. They go as consumers. Mm-hmm. And if they don't get anything out of church, then they don't go back. I think what you're driving at, I agree with, but I would prefer to go to the next step and say to participate in, to take part in. Because, you see, in one sense, what we say it happens when we have the Lord's Supper is A, that Jesus is really there, and that the cross is really there. And that's fantastic. Yes. Yeah, right. That's another good way of putting it. We bring our primarily Greek, and even that's probably not very good Greek minds. More Greek filtered through Renaissance in Rome. Italian way of thinking. I don't want to get hung up on it. Because if it bothers people that fantasy is connected with something that has no connection with reality, then that may not be a helpful way for people to think about it.
I don't think that. But I think the term has to at least the majority of people signifies non-truth.
Right. Yeah, and I wouldn't go out and just tell people, hey, come into this fantasy. I think you need to do, if you're going to do that at all.
No, they might come.
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, I haven't mentioned that link with how people use fantasy for correcting people's interpersonal relationships at various levels, physical and intellectual. Importance for people to.
Well, liturgy maybe is a dead word. Maybe fantasy might.
Yeah, of course, the liturgy literally means the people's work, and the public work, the service that they render.
That's why we're
different. Yeah, yeah, and we haven't thought of it as work. We thought of it as going to get something out of it. So you know, we pay us our money, and we expect a good sermon. And if we don't get a good sermon, we feel like the week has been. You know, we've got a bad start for the whole week, so we may go check out some other preacher. Rather than acknowledging that here is a place where we're called to enter into and become encompassed with this greatest story of all. I don't know if any of you have run across a preacher named Paul Harms or not, who's also very heavily influenced by C.S. Lewis, as, by the way, I think Walt Bowman has been. And a number of other folks. But you ought to hear him preach sometimes if you haven't. Sometimes I think he's a little bit too dramatic. But it is his contention, following a Lewis quote, that we shouldn't bore people. That it's one of the dangerous things in the world. The Christians dare never bore people. In part because the Christian faith is the most exciting story in the world. And I think if we can convey a reality that here is the most fantastic thing that happens when we celebrate the supper, and preferably every week, because you can't get the rhythm and feel if you're just alternating it. If you just lose it, you're just lost. For one thing, you can't learn to do it by heart. You're stuck with these books. So you have to stick your nose in order to remember where you are. Horrendous thing, these books. Called hymnals. You know, we don't get connected with each other, and so we get dull. But this kind of delight that you sense here of the liturgy, and some of the drama of the liturgy, needs to be restored, so that we like here they were mentioning on the Easter Vigil, they come in through, they got it from a Romanian practice, a Romanian church practice. I think it was Orthodox, Romanian Orthodox, where they come through the altar, which is like a tomb, and everybody comes in, including the very old, underneath and through that altar, so that they are remembering that they were put to death with Christ and are risen with him to newness of life. And a restoration of that great Easter Vigil is so critical, I think, for the church, because they really made a big thing of it in the early church. And it was great fantasy and great drama. And the idea of letting ourselves go and having that kind of imagination that we do when we play Pac-Man or other games, so we get into the story. And tell the story, and help us see each other tell the story, so that there's surprise in it, even in the midst of the oldest story. It's what makes a good joke, what makes good fantasy. What makes good storytelling of the oldest story in the world. It's one reason why black preachers tend to be a lot better in many ways than white preachers, because they tell the story with passion and with color. Well, I was promised we were going to do a little looking, and I should tell you about a few books if you're not aware of them. These, I believe, may be in the bookstore, but if you haven't picked them up, The Gifts of the Christ, Child Christ are a match set from Erdmann's of George MacDonald's children's stories. Don't look for them to be quite as rich in some ways as Lewis's. I mean, you won't find direct correspondences necessarily with angels all the time and all that sort of thing. But there's some really powerful stories in this series. There's another version of that called The Complete Fairy Tales of George MacDonald. I don't know if this one is. I picked these all up out of the library here, but I do think they have a few George MacDonald pieces up there. This is printed by Schocken and can be found in most places. They are really excellent stuff. Another one that strongly influenced, of course, I should mention Tolkien and The Hobbit and the whole Tolkien trilogy. Tolkien was a devout Roman Catholic. And you do not find quite the direct correspondences that you can in Lewis, but the story is there of facing tremendous odds and of being sustained by gifts to defeat evil. That evil does not, the powers and principalities will not win. They've been defeated. Many dimensions, and in a whole series, now I know these are in the bookstore, I've seen them over there, are some fascinating works. And these also influenced Lewis. Charles Williams, very fine writer that had a direct influence on Lewis. Tolkien, of course, was with Lewis part of the Inklings group, and they critiqued each other's work. I mentioned before with MacDonald, Phantastes, and Lilith. Frankly, this is Phantastes. I read Phantastes some time ago. I've got to read it again because I don't know if I was mature enough to read it with enough delight. I was looking for too much correspondences to, stuff I could use for sermons, I think, at the time. I'm going to go back and read it again. And I think that's probably a little more useful for adults. There are some other more recent works by fantasy people, and fantasy is, of course, becoming a major kind of industry almost these days, and the bookshelves are getting broader than that. I find the Dragon Song series by Anne McCaffrey to be very good. One of the reasons I like about them is that they have a young woman as a hero. Very, very seldom in the early fantasies did you find women being at the center. Another very good person for that, by the way, is Madeline L'Engel, A Wrinkle in Time. Those are up there. A Wrinkle in Time, A Crack at the Door. Crack at the Door? Well, anyway, A Wrinkle in Time, and you'll see the others right next to it in the bookstore. They're very excellent. The interesting thing about her is that her stories do not have the victors win by violence. They win by a kind of love that surrounds and accepts. I think worth reading for that reason, compared to Tolkien and even Lewis. One has to remember that Lewis wrote during the Second World War, and right near the end of the Second World War, and was writing in part a parable about the battle against evil in the name of Hitler. Wrinkle in Time by Madeline L'Engel. There are some other good ones. These are in the. This one was in the library. Narnia Rising. I don't know that much about them, but they're a good series. Frankly, there are very few fantasy series that you can really go terribly wrong on that are out there. There's also the Earthsea trilogy, and I think those are up there. I don't remember the name of the author of that offhand. And this is one I thought was kind of interesting, Sundancer, a mystical fantasy. That's pretty good. And finally, The Never-Ending Story, which I don't know if any of you were in the Bible study today, but I quoted it in the Bible study. How many were in the Bible study earlier? The interesting thing about this, I like about it, is that he has incorporated the reality of the fact of a child reading the story but becoming a part of it. And the people in the story are conscious of this reader. And also, there's one final quote that I would like to read before you leave, if you can spare just another minute or two. Because there are really two of them, but I'll just read the one. At one point, this young man is, the young man not in the story, but the hero within the story, is given a word from character very much like the Holy Spirit in some ways. It's a wind that you don't see. It's only a voice. And this voice is telling this child hero how it will rescue this world, Fantastica. For a time he heard only a plaintive sound without words. Then suddenly the voice came from right next to him as though someone were whispering into his ear. Who can give the childlike empress the new name that will make her well? Not you, not I, no elf, no djinn can save us from the evil spell. For we are figures in a book, we do what we were invented for. But we can fashion nothing new and cannot change from what we are. But there's a realm outside Fantastica, the outer world is its name. The people who live there are rich indeed and not all the same. Born of the Word, the children of man, or humans as they're sometimes called, have had the gift of giving names ever since our world began. In every age it's they who gave the childlike empress life. For wondrous new names have power to save. But now for many and many a day no human has visited Fantastica, for they no longer know the way. They have forgotten how real we are. They don't believe in us anymore. Oh, if only one child of man would come, oh, then at last the thing would be done. If only one would hear our plea, for them it is near, but for us too far. Never can we go out to them, for theirs is the world of reality. But tell me, my hero, you are so young, will you remember what I have sung?